It is the Sunday review of the sports pages. Joined in studio by Kieran Shannon and by Declan Lynch. Lads, thanks a million for coming in.
Dave.
It's a pretty blockbuster day of Sunday sport, isn't it?
Yeah,
absolutely.
And you guys have taken the time out to join us in here.
Okay, yeah. Well, actually, you have the two. You have Wimbledon final starting right now, right?
Yeah.
You have, like, which is very unusual in Gaa at this stage, you have quarterfinals in both hurling and football going on at the moment. I'm going to miss the World Cup final because I'm going to Croker straight after this for the Kerry-Galway game. So it's action-packed, yeah.
I know it's probably not a decision, Declan, for you, but for you, Kieran, if you weren't working, if you were at home this afternoon on the couch, what will you have on at 4 o'clock?
Yeah, well, it's fascinating because I kind of had a choice what to do today, and it's funny. I chose taking Kerry-Galway because I had agreed to come up to here. But there was a bit of me going when I said yes first, going, what was I thinking? The World Cup, England could be in the World Cup final. There's going to be a history. Kerry-Galway today is not historic. England in the World Cup final would have been historic. I suppose just deep down I knew that they weren't going to get there, I suppose. But I mean, you'd be, that's what the flicker's for today. I mean, you'd have to, of all of them, I'm going to be at Kerry-Galway. It's a fascinating game. But you know, you'd have to be saying you'd be flicking over to see how the World Cup final's going.
Yeah, there's a point as well when we're looking at this great, great day of sport. There's that sort of slightly fearful thought as well that it's going to be over tomorrow. what are we going to do then? You know, could they not stagger them out a little bit more? We're going to have to deal with a lot of the aftermath of this as well.
The realities of life.
Tomorrow we're going to wake up and there'll be not much going on apart from life.
which, that's pretty grim.
As I think, as we have all established at this stage, is not really up to much, you know, without. Now, there is like constant coverage of the Tour de France going on in Eurosport, which if in the absence of actually going on holidays to France or going on holidays anywhere, you can actually just use that as your holiday. You'll see that France far better and it's relatively inexpensive.
But are you not just speaking for yourself there, given that you're not the biggest GA fan of the country?
I would happily watch a GA. The point I made actually in my famous World Cup diary that there were days, you know, the rest days of the football World Cup.
Yeah, once we got through the group stages.
Yeah, you sort of think I could easily watch a match in the Rugby World Cup today if it was on. Except they don't have, they insist on having them on at a time when they're not really needed. You know, so I think there should be a position created. I would like to put myself forward for this actually, this role. Right,
okay.
Of a kind of a global organizer of sporting events to ensure that at all times there is a full and adequate supply of top level sporting action, that you never have these ridiculous situations where you'll have a rugby World Cup on when there's loads of other things on.
So like the chairperson of the global version of the CCCC?
Basically, yeah. And like, for example, one of the great errors of Qatar, apart from anything else, is that it's on around Christmas. We're fine at Christmas. Thank you very much. We've loads of things on until the Premier League destroys itself by trying to copy other less successful leagues by cutting out the winter break. We're okay at Christmas. Mm. Thanks very much.
What are we going to do in the summer of 2022?
Precisely. One of the many attractions of a World Cup is that it's actually on in these terrible wastelands of June and July. So these are important things. And I'm putting myself forward now for this role.
Okay. Who do you need to speak to about it?
Well, I'd first need to go to one of the summer schools to put myself forward. The fellas who are looking for roles, I always go to one of those places and start talking about the need for this role, you know, and
so you won't have a World Cup diary to write about next week, really?
I might just keep doing it for a few weeks as a kind of a methadone thing, you know.
A cathartic thing, just for yourself.
Exactly, for myself.
Yeah. There are one or two people who would read it as well and who might think, you know, Asher, I'd be happy enough to read about what it was like about 2 weeks ago.
Obviously, the papers are dominated by the World Cup final. They're also dominated by the GA, and there's a couple of other very interesting pieces that we will get to that will draw our attention over the next hour or so. Just run you through the headlines. The Sunday Independent have gone with Scully's Super Show, but new format starts with a whimper. We'll get to Kieran on that in a moment. The Sunday Times, Dubs do enough. All-Ireland champions labour to victory over Donegal. Hazard's Blues exit hint puts rail on alert. A lot of talk that Eden Hazard will be heading through the Stamford Bridge exit door in the next couple of weeks. And a very interesting chat with the Bohemians keeper Shane Supple, part of which is on the front page of the Sunday Independent Sports Supplement. And the Republic of Ireland need to build character. It's a pretty damning message that Shane Supple is putting out there, having spent a few days as part of the squad before ahead of the France friendly game last month. So we'll get into that. The Mail have gone with who's next. Dublin show no signs of slippage with dismissal of Salah Donegal. The Sunday World, Super Dub simply great. Paul Pogba of France is also telling us we haven't won anything yet. The Irish Sunday People lead with football. England bowed but proud, and Giroud heading out. Sarri's Higuain raid spells end for Giroud at Chelsea. The Irish Sunday Mirror, red alert. Jim Gavin demands better before the visit to Tyrone. The Irish Sun on Sunday, for all the world, is the lead headline. Croatian coach Zlatko Dalic has called on the whole world to roar his minnows to glory. And the Star on Sunday, go with the brave new world, finishing fourth, not enough for Harry Kane. A lot of what we talk about, lads, will be World Cup orientated, but I want to go through some of the GA stuff first. It was a rather underwhelming start to the era of the Super 8, Kieran, wasn't it? I know you were in Cork yesterday.
Well, that was even more underwhelming. It was more underwhelming, unfortunately. I mean, I can't think of a smaller crowd for, like, it was an All-Ireland quarter-final set. Certainly since the All-Ireland quarter-final era has come in, that's the smallest crowd per game. I mean, you've had double bills, but they've had 20,000 plus. So the Super 8's atmosphere, was just watching it from a remote, you know, down in Cork on the TV, and
Very eerie.
Declan was just having this argument about, well, should they have the quarterfinal round games in Croke Park? I think you have to have at least one game in Croke Park, whether it should be the opening game of it or not. There has to be. I mean, if you're a Kerry Galway player today, you need to be playing in A. It is a reward in itself, like getting to play in Croke Park, whether you came through the provincials or whether you came through the qualifiers. You have to play a game there, but unfortunately, the way it worked out yesterday, there was 53,000, but you would have had, if you were a Scammon fan, you weren't sticking around.
No, there was no stage of the afternoon at which there were 53,000 in Croke Park.
Because sometimes when it's a proper bill, let's say when Donegal and Dublin played in an All-Ireland quarter-final 2 years ago, you had Tyrone Mayo before that. I would say you had a lot of overlap for the second half of that game. Dubs would have wanted to go in and see that, whereas with Roscommon and Tyrone, it was different. I mean, Tommy Conlon had a colour piece, and he counted the amount of dubs that were in the hill. Was it 15 minutes before throwing? I think it was 49 dubs had gone to the bother. Interestingly, and you have that game was in Dublin, which would be considered, it's got the most fanatical football following the country, along with Pass, arguably Mayo. Cork, hurling, massive. How little neutrals were attracted to the bill, you know? That's surprising that there isn't more of an effort maybe made to attract more of the local people, you know, because...
But is that not the argument then, to have any these bigger matches, like, you know, it's like the Kildare thing, you know, far be it from me to be advising the GAA about what they should be doing, but like, you know, is it not inherently better to have a full house in, a place in Kildare or in Roscommon or in Tyrone or
they're
whatever.
Going to that.
Well,
now.
We'll get that next week. Yeah. We'll get round two. All these teams are going to be.
This is the first season where the GAA have actually really embraced that. Certainly in hurling, where let's say I've come up from Ennis today. That was what was particularly unusual about yesterday, where you would have had that Clare team playing in front of 15,000 against Waterford, packed 19,000 in Limerick, where there's half the crowd at an All-Ireland quarter-final.
Yeah.
But this is the first year where, let's say, in 25 years, where there's been a Munster Championship match in Clare. They're beginning to get it, Declan. Mm. But there's more to be done on that. But in terms of, there has to be a round in Croke Park, where I'm sure they'll be reviewing which of the rounds do they do it
in. Yeah, I think it's a difficulty having it as the opening round, because the fans of all the seven counties that aren't Dublin know they have to travel, that their team are going to be out for each of the next 2 weeks. There's a lot of cost involved with the expense of your tickets and getting there, and there was just so few people there yesterday.
What you're going to have now, right? Because Kevin McStay pretty much admitted that they're out of the running for the Super 8. He talked about pride next week. But even if they take that win off Donegal, right? Because you could have a situation in some of the groups where it comes down to point difference, and it could be a team that's 1-1, lost 2. There might be a team with 3-0. Roscommon, because of minus 18, and then their last game, even if they beat Donegal, is against Dublin, which now you could argue, how many are going to be at that? You could actually get it in Parnell Park, but the thing is the Dubs haven't trained. What I found fascinating about that whole debate, and they were trying to be diplomatic and talking about Parnell Park's our nominal home ground. We went over. Dublin haven't trained in Parnell Park in 7 years. So like they will not play in Parnell Park. No. But you know what? You could have a situation where it'll be like a National League crowd, maybe 22,000 at it. But that's what that'll be. But I don't know what the crowds are like for Kildare Monaghan today.
They certainly hadn't sold many tickets by yesterday.
Yeah.
Now, whether it doesn't look right, the one really interesting aspect for me from the potential scenarios of the Super 8 is we could be going into the final round with Tyrone having beaten Dublin perhaps next Saturday, Donegal having beaten Roscommon, and then Donegal will go into the Tyrone game knowing that if they win, they still have a chance to qualify. Well, and it comes down to points difference because everyone's beaten everybody else.
I mean, the group that's on today, there's so little between them.
Yeah.
Like Monaghan will really fancy themselves having Kerry at home. Kildare are fancying them today. I don't know how it's going. Well, there we are, 1 point game.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they played, I see it's back raining today. I remember them playing a last 12 game, was it 4 years ago? I went to overtime, like extra time, like because it was a last 12 game. It won't be obviously that today, but it's going to be that tight. So I think we're going to see two really competitive games today, which we didn't have yesterday.
Yeah.
Although Donegal played some decent stuff.
They did, and maybe they've just believed in themselves a bit more. They may have had an opportunity to actually do something pretty seismic yesterday. A lot of the GA pieces in the papers today are match reports and match previews of today's game, so we're not going to get into them. But there was one interesting piece I found. It was Marie Crowe on the Sunday Independent. She's had a really interesting sit-down with Eamon Callaghan, the former Kildare captain, now 35 years old, in his 16th season playing with Kildare. Mm-hmm. And the first two paragraphs are interesting. When asked about the availability to meet in the days leading up to today's game against Monaghan in the opening round of the Super 8s, Callaghan's first surprise was that he said yes. His second was that he could only meet at certain times because he was working nights, not the response you expect from an intercounty footballer these days. He's working late shifts for the Gardaí. He's stationed in Luke, and he also has an 8-month-old baby at home. Mm. And you know yourself, Kieran, from trying to get guys to have a chat with you in the build-up to games, that is not the response you anticipate nowadays.
No, I mean, like, I do a big interview slot every Saturday for the Examiner, and to be honest with you, 90% of the time at this time of year, like, I almost use the Kimmage rule, which is you have to be over 30. You know, Eamon has, he's over 30, he's able to give a role. But I go the other route even now. I go just for former players who have something to say, and they're freer to say it. Like, it's interesting Marie went with that intro, because I had a piece with a player, except they were out of it yesterday, with Neil Ewing from Sligo talking about the direction sport is going. And I made that point of, he actually, let's say, contacted me. Marie's on about how it's unusual to get a correspondence for a player back. And it is unusual because, let's say, 8 days ago she didn't know that Kildare were going to go through. They only won through to the last day, last Saturday, up in Navan against Fermanagh. And so that added a bit of colour to it, and I know Declan was talking about just...
Well, this is the thing you always have to... You're always reminded of the oddity of the whole thing when, you know, in no other probably, you know, newspaper in the world will you be reading about a top-level sportsman who, by the way, is working nights as a policeman. You know, and it's remarkable. An odd thing about interviewing them as well is that a friend of mine interviewed a leading GAA player who agreed, or no, who just suggested that, you know, they meet halfway. Like, my friend was coming from Dublin, and so he met him, say, around Arklow or something, right? And my friend was saying, you know, what do you mean? Like, sort of, sure, you know, that's fair enough. Like, should we meet halfway? Now, this friend of mine was used to interviewing Premier League players, and the notion, the very concept that the other guy would say, well, I tell you what, why don't we meet sort of somewhere in the middle, you know, because that'd be fair, is so alien as to be obviously ridiculous.
It's rare you get that, actually. It's funny you say it. This was the first year I think I've had that, and certainly in a long time, with Turlough O'Brien from Carlow, who again is very generous, trying to build up the Carlow brand more than himself, to be fair. It's not self-promotion, it's Carlow promotion, you know. And he did the same. He agreed to meet us in Portlaoise. Now, as it turned out, which was in the piece, was he was coming up because this shows you you're on about coverage and the lower tier counties and everything. He says, because they're not on TV, etc., that you get the local papers. He'd go up, and that way he was able to get a lot of the local papers from the... There was a shop in Portlaoise that sold all the papers of the counties that are in Division 4, so it was a bit of a recce job as well. Just that courtesy, you know, and Eamon Callaghan provided a courtesy to Marie.
Yeah.
And he also provided the courtesy of giving an interesting interview.
And to be fair to Eamon, and it's not just because he's, you know, in the twilight of his career and he's mature and experienced enough to trust that he's not going to say something stupid. He's actually always been like that. I many times over the years.
I don't know the guy, but he comes across very well here.
An absolute gentleman, Eamon, and he's brilliant with his time. And he doesn't, as you say, with Marie's piece here, he just doesn't give you the usual truck answers that no one really wants to hear about.
I found his relationship with McGeaney, and this, I think McGeaney obviously has been a divisive figure. He's taken stick particularly, well, he got stick when he made Kildare competitive. And which isn't an easy thing to do. I mean, their decline post McGeaney would confirm that, because they were routinely making the last eight in McGeaney's time. They nearly took it for granted. Well, Callaghan didn't, and the way that he talked about that honesty, where he talks about how McGeaney changed my whole lifestyle and how I think about football, and he talked about after they were knocked out of the 2010 Leinster Championship, which ended up then in the back door being probably their best year, and they probably could have and should have won in All-Ireland. He talked about, I met Kieran after that and he went through me. No shouting or roaring at me. He just plain and simply laid out a lot of things that he felt about my game and my personality and the way I approached training, and I couldn't believe it. One of the things was that I was lazy. I would never consider myself a lazy footballer, and that struck with me. I felt embarrassed and I knew he was right and I wanted to prove him wrong then. And it goes on. That's an interesting scene.
It's the one thing a player would never really stand for, being told, because I guess every player thinks they're working as hard as they possibly can, they're doing everything they can to be the best player they can be, and then for the manager, this guy you have so much respect for, to pull you into a meeting and just say, you're just lazy, you're just not doing what's required here. And he just changed everything after that. I found there's a little bit of regret in there, because he would have been 27 at the time. Whereas, you know, there were four or five years where he would have been at his peak physically. Yeah. And I mean, he must wonder and look, well, did I actually do everything I could have done before McGeezer pulled me aside?
Because even in the McGeaney era, for as competitive as they were, and they kept getting back to quarterfinals in the All-Ireland, the only year they got to the Leinster final was the previous year, 09. That was a moment where Dublin had yet to really take off, and Dublin still beat them with a man down, beat them by 3 points. And, you know, you're looking at those things as a setup. Why didn't we do it? There's more in Eamon Callaghan.
Yeah.
You know, so I found that particular piece fascinating about it.
He was pretty hard on the GA as well, around the Newbridge and Nova situation, where he was saying, you know, the GA were deluded, is what he, to quote him.
What was interesting was it was sent out in the WhatsApp, and that's what the players themselves wanted. And then they stuck together on it. Look, that's a whole... That one's been well covered.
There's a great picture with that piece as well. And I don't know if it's credited, but it looks like it's this kind of wasteland background. You know, it looks like a picture from the NME, the 1978 of the Gang of Four in Sheffield, something like that. One of those kind of
Sid Vicious.
So it's kind of interesting. It's not the usual backdrop, you know. It's not sort of,
I think that's from St. Conlon's Newbridge. That's why people wanted it out of it, is it? I mean, that's possibly where it is.
It's a wall that hasn't had a lick of paint in a long time, but it's peeling. And it is, it's a lovely piece with Eamon. Look, it may be the last we see from him as a player, whether or not he decides to come back next year, because he's not really a starter on the team. But we saw the role he can play when he came off the bench and kicked a really crucial score in the final minutes against Mayo. GA wise, it's pretty light after that. So there's a lovely piece with Mick Foley in the Sunday Times, where he's comparing Maurice Fitzgerald and David Clifford. Maurice was 18 in 1988, Clifford's 19. Mm-hmm. Maurice won an All-Star in his first year, but had to wait
on
3 years.
On the back of one game. That was how it was back then.
A Munster final against Cork, they lost.
Whatever you say, you wouldn't have particularly felt too sorry for Kerry players of that generation, but he was in that in between generation. And let's say they got Cork. Well, it would have been two games, they won a game or two to win, get to a Munster final, and then they lost by 1 point to Cork in a very good game, and he was outstanding. He got an All Star in the back of one game. I mean, that's going to be completely different to the year we have now. But I think Mick's piece, I only had a cursory look at it, but it is that he's coming into a different setup. Clifford doesn't have to carry the load and be the superstar, because that Kerry team were in decline. You know, that's the day of the famous photograph where you had Ger Power, Mikey, all the party, all the boys in the dugout. That was that day, but those guys, let's say, weren't on the field. It was a relatively underwhelming Kerry forward line that started that day, whereas Clifford's coming into a team where, for all the young guns they have, you would like to think, you would hope that James Donoghue is reapproaching his peak.
There's a very nice quote from Sean O'Sullivan, where he says, I was 8 years old when Maurice Fitz was coming on the scene, but it was a different kind of hype. Morris came into a Kerry team that drastically needed him. The county needed him. Kerry were looking for someone to cling to. David isn't coming into a team starved of stars or forwards, and that's great for him. There's a bit of pressure because of the minor exploits, but it's not the same as Morris.
Yeah, well, like, Morris wouldn't have had pressure in 88, let's say, but let's say when, by the time Morris was in years like 93, 94, 95, it would be unfair to say that it was a one-man team, but it was him and nobody else.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, that Kerry team still have very strong players, like, who are in their prime. So he and then he has a wave. He's just one off a wave that they have. Although we're going to see what they're really made of today, and that's why today is going to be fascinating, the Galway game.
Yeah, this is the Sunday Paper Review brought to you this afternoon with Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products. Let's just get into the World Cup, Declan, because there are a few very interesting pieces, and I guess Eamon Sweeney always has something worth reading, whether you agree or disagree wholeheartedly with him, on the back of the Sunday Independent today. But no shame in not cheering for England. He's had enough, basically, Declan, of the "it's coming home" line.
Yeah, I mean, I my own attitude is that, you know, I would prefer England to be in the final today because it would be a better laugh, basically. You know what I mean? We would be more engaged with it, obviously. I mean, you don't even have to state this. Obviously, France and England is more interesting to us than France and Croatia. You know, it would be more entertaining. It would be, you know, if possible, a better World Cup final than the one. So, like, I think the whole tone of these things is important because there's very little intensity anymore in the way people approach these things. You know, someone asked me during the week to go on a radio program to talk about who I'd be supporting on Wednesday night. I said, oh, I was supporting England. But it was only because they asked me. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, I mean, well, of course I will. Why would I be supporting Croatia? Like, I want the better, you know, I want the finals of England to be in the final, obviously.
Yeah, it was for selfish reasons you're supporting.
Why would anyone think otherwise? Do you know? I mean, we are so connected with England now in so many ways that we just know them.
Yeah.
That, you know, and like, so obviously it's going to be, so I don't see how you could get sort of all that worked up about it even, you know, except to think like, you know, well, obviously, like, you just want England to be in it because it would make the kind of crack last a bit longer. Now, there are totally different sort of aspects to Croatia and France. It's interesting in its own way, but not in a way that has a particular sort of pull for us, I think.
Do you, as I said, mean? Like, about it would be historic, and, you know, the notion, telling years on that, God, I was in Croke Park watching Kerry Galway when England were playing in a World Cup final, whereas today it doesn't have the same relevance. I've been up here quite a few times reviewing this slot, and would have often regularly said, complimented Eamon on pieces, and that it's a go-to place. I think he's well off on this.
You disagree with the tone?
I totally disagree with the tone. It reminded me of, you know, like, we would have done debating societies, and you're given a motion, even though you don't believe in it, you're arguing your case, right? That's the nature of a debate. And if the debate makes a good enough point, fair enough. It seems like he was given this card, try and make something of it, and it's not a particularly strong argument. I mean, the notion that, why should we support England? We're not English. Well, first of all, I don't know any Croatians. First of all, I have nieces and nephews who are English, because they were Irish. He talks about here, most irritating of all was the constant refrain that Irish people should throw themselves wholeheartedly behind the English because they were very good about giving Irish people jobs over there. Well, a lot of those Irish people are still over there. And you know what? They've given a lot of our footballers jobs over there, and their children are becoming English. I don't, as I said, to me it was mean-spirited. I felt it was a piece that, I mean, I'm not telling that everyone, you should support England. But the notion,
that's the definition of supporting them anyway. Like, you'd like to see them in the final, you might like to see them get to a semi-final. It's not like these people are walking around wearing England shirts.
No, I just thought the line here, it's people saying this article has been written during every finals in living memory, you know, about, he calls people who are advocating this point Ireland's most boring men, and about its author sound like middle-aged lads trying to impress a barmaid by going, you know, I think everyone's sexuality is their own business, so it is. I just find it's a bit, like, who's he talking about, Ireland's most boring men, saying that? You know what, like, is Declan, is that who he's talking about? I just find, as I said, a great time for Eamon Sweeney, and what you want a piece to do, even like you were talking about Newbridge or nowhere, I actually happen to be someone said that it should be somewhere else. And I had several people who would have said, you know what, I still disagree with you, but you got me to think. And Eamon often, even when I don't agree with him, has got me to think. This didn't. I think it fell off the mark. So that's just on this one. Look, it's, you're talking about consistency. 52 articles a week, he's there, and he often is on the money or it gets you thinking. But I just thought that one was
yeah,
petty.
I mean, I think there's a dynamic to it as well, to the whole England thing, that it doesn't really lend itself, I think, anymore to sort of clear-cut positions one way or the other. Like, at any given England game, half the time we want them to win and half the time we don't, almost simultaneously, right?
The ideal
thing
is...
That's what's kind of engaging about
I think, you know, a lot of people would be like, nearly the ideal thing. You want them to win because the longer they're in it, the more that you're engaged in it. You just maybe hope that they don't actually win the whole thing.
It's like the Champions League. You might hate Liverpool or Manchester United, but you really want to see them maybe go to the quarter semi-final of the Champions League.
It's like
it's going to be far more entertaining than
said about some other issues. You know, yes, and in what way does this make life any less boring, right? You know, clearly, you know, England getting knocked out in the first round, you know, obviously it's good crack. But it does make life just a bit more boring, you know. So I'd be always in favour of
it. Particularly when we're not in it, you know. You didn't mind them going out early in 88. Our game was televised live against Holland. It was the one where it was still in play, you know. But
were you a bit more happy? Were you happier to support? I think support is the wrong word, but, you know, happy enough to see England go the all this far in the tournament because of the manager, because Eamon Sweeney again, and a lot of a narrative around the papers today is that, you know, Southgate's been heralded as this messiah, this game changer, this guy who's booked 40-50 years of history.
I think we all actually, it was very interesting what happened during the week because everybody got carried away. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't just the English who got carried away. Like, I was thinking that they'd probably win on Wednesday, and you know, I now realise that was ridiculous.
But wait,
you know,
Declan, if they go 2-0 up, they win.
Yeah,
they should have been 2-0 up.
I
mean, it was our old friend, game of two halves, and then it was extra time where Croatia dominated it as well.
But I think we forgot, I mean, the lines that were being put out about Croatia. I mean, it's now, you see in several pieces now where people are saying that Croatia used this thing about England, you know, describing them as being old and, you know, or being sort of tired and this kind of stuff. But a lot of us kind of, it's funny the way a line sticks, right? And even if it kind of can be argued with, it kind of gets into people's heads, oh, they've had a couple of long games, they'll be tired and they're a bit old, right? But God's sake, it's the quarterfinal of the World Cup. Do you know what I mean? But like all the extra time and everything they had to play, like. So, maybe they will and maybe they won't, but the line stuck, right? And that enabled us to think, oh, sure, England, yeah, England will beat these old fellas, right? But it's just wrong. And you forget then, sure, they've got Modric there and England have like Jordan Henderson. You know what I mean? They're hardly the same species as footballers, let alone kind of, worthy rivals.
And yet,
you know,
if Kane takes that chance... You know, there's,
well, if Kane takes that chance, fine. But that doesn't mean England are going to defend the two-goal lead either. You know, given
ultimately, they would have, like, you know, the twos.
But I think they'd be in the final if they had got there.
Yeah, but
that's irrelevant.
No, but,
I don't think. I just think Croatia showed themselves to be on basically a higher level than England, and they on more or less all kind of aspects of the game, apart from the fact we've just been better footballers.
Well, there are more experienced footballers too. That, you know. I mean, there were pieces during the week that showing the relative Champions League background. I mean, obviously the Roy Keane thing about the supporters getting carried away, the pundits getting carried away, but before that he made some decent points about, let's say, like, a lot of teams are, like, the core of the team has tended to be, like, the Spurs and Liverpool, let's say. Well, you're talking about Jordan Henderson, who are getting to be competitive, but let's say haven't been really through the last 16, last 8 regularly enough. Like the when you look at the cumulative amount of Champions League games that the Croatian team had compared to England, like England are a work in progress. They weren't the finished product.
Yeah, and there was also the fact as well, you see, that they really hadn't beaten much. Do you know what I mean?
So that's true.
Like, that was true as well. And yet people were prepared to forget about that. I mean, the qualifying group, it was almost like they were almost playing like Leinster League teams in retrospect, you know. So I just found it very interesting the way, like, if you're like normally sensible people even got carried away.
But then sensible people are getting carried away about people getting carried away.
Yeah.
Like, there's the line about Graeme Souness having the line, like his intro, right? is actually, I have the Shane Supple piece in front of me, we'll come to that in a bit, but where it's actually a good piece, Souness, and he gets into the nitty-gritty about Jordan Henderson versus Luka Modric and where England could have been better. But his line about how the English FA or England should really have control of it's coming home. I mean, like that was
exactly
ridiculous. I mean, exactly. Shane McGrath had a good line, I think, in his piece, basically saying that, I think the way Shane puts it, is it's coming home was not a flat declaration of arrogance. It was the sound of a people getting excited. Mm.
You know, yeah, I mean, if Souness is, like, he doesn't understand that. There are a lot of football pundits just are completely, you know, blind and deaf to those kind of broader kind of cultural things.
Like, Roy Keane was in the same boat, wasn't he, when he had just, a go at Ian Wright and...
I remember
doing a book with Mickey Hart, let's say, when Tyrone won their first All-Ireland. I remember him always saying, like, let the supporters enjoy it. It's brilliant. Lead up to an All-Ireland. Just the players are going to be different. So let the supporters get excited. But the notion that the England team were in the dressing room after beating Sweden going, it's coming home, that doesn't happen like that. I mean, there was a very good tweet by Kate Kirby, one of the leading sports psychs with the Institute of Sport, saying that England should look to change that song, that it's not as process-driven, it's, you know, one game at a time mindset, and that Ireland's give it a lash, Jack, is more like it. But, like, I remember, like, if you remember, like, when Donegal, Jimmy's winning matches, like, that was after they beat Kerry. I mean, they had yet to go through Cork and Mayo. But you know what? It was a people going, nearly like it had been 1992, 1990 since England being in a semi-final. They were getting excited for the first time. Having fun. Gareth's winning matches. No, he didn't win at all. Jimmy did win at all. It's got nothing to do with it, the song. And actually, it just reminded me what a bloody lovely song it is. It's much better than... New Order would have a better discography,
sure,
but I think...
But it reminded you as well that, like, you see, England is in a terrible mess at the moment, right? And basically its ruling class are utterly degenerate and are destroying everything, right? And in the middle of all this, apart from just giving people a bit of fun with the World Cup, it's coming home. It showed that one thing England have a genius for is making great pop records, right? Mm. Great pop music. That is a huge thing. That's an enormously important contribution to humanity.
I mean,
right?
All you've
been looking at is Jacob Rees-Mogg and these terrible, terrible people, right? These the worst people in the world, right? And in the middle, this morass of awfulness, they just for a few moments, this thing allowed England to demonstrate at least one thing: we're great at this thing. We're really brilliant at least one thing, right? And you know, Souness not getting that is fine, but I mean, like, he doesn't get it, right? And it is important, and it did, you know. I don't think the record or whatever is what they're on about at all. I mean, it's just some attitude they took from it. But I think Croatia will take whatever they want to take out of it. It doesn't mean it's true. You know what I mean? If something fired them up, something artificial that they took out of it, that's their own psychology. Nothing wrong whatsoever with that record. In fact, the opposite is true. And it was a crucial part of the whole. For about 3 or 4 days, there was just a good atmosphere, and it just helped everything and showed that England are actually good at things, you know, instead of other than self-destruction.
And showed
And McAvoy wrote a very good piece in yesterday's Examiner making that exact point. Like, how you're talking about, I think people have begun to respect, like, a certain leadership. Southgate is not, like, his team, the finished product. But you know what? He's learning, and there is a dignity about the man. And that's what Enda's outro was, basically, that, you know, Gareth's the only man to handle the Brexit situation. I think there is a crass Britain, the same way there's a crass America. And then there's a better England, and there's a better America. And I think there's a bit of that with this team. I think Southgate, again, like, he's made errors, and actually Souness was very good on both the TV afterwards and about in his column today about their shortcomings. But overall, I mean, which leads us on to the pieces with an Irish angle, both Shane Supple and with Paul Rowan in the Times, and then Shane McGrath in the Mail today. Like, I would like if we had a setup with a leader like Gareth.
Yeah, we'll get into that, because that's definitely something I want to touch on. But the halftime whistle is gone in the two big games, the All-Ireland Hurling quarter-final down. Are we on Thurles first, Richie, or are we heading to Croker? We're heading to Thurles. Tommy Walsh standing by. Limerick just about shading a pretty entertaining first half of the rain, Tommy.
Yes, Dave, it's an absolute belter here in Thurles. 15 points to Limerick, 12 points to Kilkenny. Kilkenny did all the front running at the start, Dave. They really came out of traps early. Richie Hogan came in at the start, as we said. He scored 3 points from play. He's flying it. The midfielders, who, you know, felt last week they were probably under pressure against that Galway midfield, especially in the first half, they've scored. James Maher scored 3 points, and Conor Fogarty has scored a point. They were absolutely flying it. But in the last 10 minutes, Limerick, the momentum is after shifting back to Limerick. They're playing the diagonal ball beautifully here, and that's what you need with forwards of the calibre of these Limerick forwards, where they just love having fast ball into them, and they're really starting to make hay now. But it's really a forwards game here in Thurles, Dave.
Okay, brilliant stuff, Tommy. We'll be back to you at full time. Ross Munley has been watching the first half of Monaghan Kildare at Croke Park, and it's Monaghan with the upper hand, Ross.
Yeah, that's right. Monaghan 10 points to 8. Obviously, the Kildare goal was crucial for them, probably to keep them in this game early on, because Monaghan have got all of their scores from points. When you contrast to Kildare, they have 6 scores. So 10 scores to 6 is tells a bit of a story itself. Monaghan are getting through that little bit better. And I said to you at the start, it'll be interesting to see who sets the tone of the game, and it has been Monaghan. I think they'll be more so happy with the first half performance, but Kildare are still in this game big time, and they're just staying in touch every time. But interestingly enough, Monaghan are going for a spine and their full forward line, with Conor McManus closest to goals, and then they've Conor McCarthy just outside him, and Shane Carey playing kind of on the 40. So they're lining up in that spine formation, and Kildare have Owen Dial kind of permanently sweeping. On the contrast, Kildare up the other end, they've gone for more of a traditional three-man full forward line. And interestingly enough, they've played, Kevin Feely has played all of the first half inside there with Daniel Flynn and Neil Flynn. So contrast in styles, as I said, Monaghan will be a little bit more comfortable with how things are at half-time. The game hasn't taken life yet, still a little bit of shadow boxing. And I had said at the start or before the game, I expected Vinnie Corey to pick up Paul Cribben, and he's done that. And both of their GPS trackers will account for the very same mileage at half time, because Vinnie has gone everywhere with Paul Cribben, and he's dominating that battle at the moment. Paul Cribben isn't really in the game, and Vinnie has had 2 shots from play himself. So if Kildare are going to explode in the second half, they'll need Paul Cribben to overturn that particular duel.
To you for the second half, and Ross is going to be there all the way through the afternoon, talking us through Kerry Galway as well. David Brady's going to be in studio with us as well. Plenty of your texts coming in at 53106 for 30 cents. You can tweet us at Off the Ball as well. Hi lads, this is from Sean. The England thing is local rivalry. Man City fans don't get behind United when they exit the Champions League. It's not that we hate England or English people. Mike's very specific. Declan, you were saying, you know, you kind of like to see England go deep into the tournament because it just makes life more interesting. Well, Mike says, I supported England. They were the first country to offer a bailout in 2008. They came over here to play rugby when we were under threat from IRA thugs. They supported our World Cup bid when Scotland and Wales did not. So very clear, reasoned, rational reasons for getting behind England's bid to bring football and the World Cup home. Lads, you're spot on. The joy was fabulous and would always be short-lived. And why shouldn't people feel it and take a break from the difficulty that is life in England in 2018? It was all about dignity, optimism and hope. Let's get carried away with this every time, for Margaret in Dublin. And that's just what Roy Keane and Graeme Souness weren't getting.
No, they weren't. And just a simple thing, like, just take it back. No, actually, like, I'm living in Clare, and we have a small little soccer club my young fella's playing, and he loved listening to the Lightning Seeds song. He's 6, right? And, like, without ever explaining to him, like, why he should feel bad about supporting England, the guy who helps me out with the soccer is from England, right? That's one thing. But the second thing is, we had a blitz there a couple of weeks ago, and at the end of it, all the teams came together and started singing just spontaneously, ole, ole, ole. Now, we weren't in it, But it was ole, ole, ole. I was just thinking, 28 years on, they're singing that song. And it had the lyric, and we'll really shake them up when we win the World Cup. Now, we did not win the World
Cup. Cost us the World Cup, bringing that song out before we even go over there.
You know, but you know what? And that's what it is. And you know, and it goes back to you say the spirit of it. So, no, let's have, and hopefully we're singing ole, ole, being at one of the things, maybe in 2 years' time, or even Qatar.
Yeah, funnily enough, one of the, you know, Keane was being regarded as being graceless in some of his reactions to the England stuff. And oddly enough, Martin O'Neill was regarded as being graceless to the Croatians. Remember with the Slaven Bilic?
Yeah.
He was muttering about, you know, you already said that. Bilic was on it, but was very emotional, I think, after one match, saying after Croatia won, and he was saying that, you know, we were such a small country and all this. And for some bizarre reason, you know, O'Neill started making little jibes at him, you know, saying, like, you know, you've said that already. It was just so strange, you know, because, you know, there had been no kind of build-up to this or anything, and yet all this Bilic was doing was almost giving the most standard response, that he was very moved by the fact that they'd won the match. And in this, you know, situation where normally people would just stand back and let him display his emotion, for some reason O'Neill felt obliged to sort of have a little crack at him, you know.
Speaking of graceless, we've got a text in from an anonymous texter. What are you gobshites on about? Your support England turning off radio, idiots. It's a reasoned, educated, rational text there. So.
Well, you see, it is a free country as well, you see. So, like, that's part of the thing we have to remember as well, that, you know, you can support anyone you bloody well like.
You can, indeed. You know,
there are no rules here.
You can send text just like that if you bloody well like. Speaking of Martin O'Neill and the World Cup and what we could potentially learn from Gareth Southgate, Kieran, an interesting piece in the Sunday Times today with Paul Rowan talking to the Bohemians goalkeeper Shane Supple, who was of course called into the Ireland squad for the friendlies, and he was on the bench for the game against France.
He obviously doesn't expect to be called back in.
Well, he certainly won't be called up again.
He won't be again. but it shows you what the suspicion, like Shane McGrath has written a piece along similar lines. Shane obviously hasn't been inside the camp no more than us, but Shane Supple has been in the camp, and it confirms what a lot of us on the outside think, which is that Shane Supple has been in the Dublin circle. You ask him what's a better setup, what's a better high performance setup, about how they go about things. And, you know, as Declan was talking about the amateur sportman playing in front of 50,000, right? It is the so-called amateur setup, which, like, and it goes back to this notion, and they talk about it in shorthand in psychology terms, like about the growth mindset versus the fixed mindset, which is that, like, the growth mindset it's about, I'm constantly learning, I'm not the finished product here, and if you have a setback, right, what has that taught me? And, like, Gareth Southgate had a lot to learn, because he was coming from a different base compared to a Martin O'Neill. Ideally, you want someone who's experienced, who still has the growth mindset. But like Shane's talking about how the likes of Trapattoni and O'Neill, who have obviously had great records in the game, but are they still hungry? You're talking about the way they've been going on in the studio. I'd love to know what they were doing during the day. Are they just hanging around with Righty and the boys, or being by themselves, or are they actually going and maybe meeting people from the other FAs or some of the support staff of the teams that are still in the World Cup, or who maybe just exited, to learn about how they're doing things? Like, and Shane Supple is talking about it here. I mean, Paul is talking about, has a line here about how the players' self-regulation would enhance the Ireland group and make them improve as a unit, as in a team. He makes the point about how Trapattoni had rules, but there's a difference between rules and standards. Players come up with the standards. That's what Dublin have created. Now, it's an element of a Gavin will create the climate for them both to say what those standards would be. But, like, I mean, it's obvious that that's one thing that has struck him, that the players don't have an ownership. You create leaders off the field to create them on the field. Like, that's what Dublin have, hugely. It's player-driven. Like, what was disappointing for me was hearing, like, when Ireland had the couple of friendlies this year earlier, is I don't like, you can talk about style of play, and that's often when, let's say, when John comes in here, it'll be about the style of play. But it's more than that. It's going back to what Shane Suttle's talking about. It's what's it like within the group? What are the training sessions like? And even a simple thing that I highlighted this, and we still got out of the group for the Euros in 2014, or for 2016 after the Scotland game 1-1, where this tick he has of only letting the players know an hour before the game. that they, in other words, they haven't rehearsed it at the session the day before, and yet that's still continuing.
And look, we've talked about that in detail. I mean, like, it's on this show.
So I think Shane McGrath, and but the fact that it comes from Shane, so like, I would hope that that now, before we go in to the new round format that we have, let's say before we play actually Denmark and Wales again, that hopefully the World Cup, and as you said, Roy Keane has been generous, Declan, you were saying in some of his commentary about Southgate, to find out about, let's say, how have they become more cohesive, as opposed to when they had much superior talent in, let's say, the Ericsson years and underachieved. You know, if they got that, if they did a good recce at the World Cup, that would be brilliant. Shane Supple is saying...
There's a couple of damning pieces in this article, Declan. Paul Ron writes that Supple would like to have seen better practices in place. This is when he was in and around the squad. Better habits that he believes breed better teams. We're not kids anymore, says Supple. We don't need our mammies and daddies to be looking after us. You throw your dirty gear outside your room, the kit man comes along and picks it up. That wouldn't be my way of doing things. You have to build character, and if we want to improve our national team, we've got to start creating better people as well. And on O'Neill, he says, he was similar to Joe Royle, who I played with under at Ipswich. Joe would stand back and watch training from a distance and let his coaching staff look after all that. He would pick the team on a Saturday. Your men, go out and play. That's the way it is. But the game has evolved a lot since then, and players are looking for more direction with the information and technology available. That is there for the international team as well, but a lot of the lads utilise it. Martin, though, would leave it up to the boys themselves. Again, that old attitude, you're grown men, this is the way it is, go out on the pitch and do your job, simple as that. We knew from an awful lot of hearsay and stories that we would get through the squad, Declan, that
it's this
is the way
Martin O'Neill... It's a great interview to get, wasn't it?
It was a great interview to get. It's the way Martin O'Neill does things.
Yeah, it's a great interview. But one of the odd things, I've almost like forgotten that Ireland play international football at all. You know, quite seriously, in the throughout the tournament, you're so kind of engaged with the thing. You have to keep reminding yourself, you know, we're actually eligible for this. We're qualified for this if we can get it together.
We were in a playoff.
We were looking good after 10 minutes ago.
It seems so long ago, doesn't it?
When Denmark were knocked out.
Yeah, and Denmark almost outclassed us a bit in that. It was one of those matches where the 5-1, that it wasn't just that they beat us, but they kind of were on a different level. And then at the World Cup, they just like looked like a bunch of journeymen. So maybe we don't want to think too much about that. Maybe that's it. There was a kind of little bit of denial in that. That we, like, let's just park the international thing for a while.
Well, I suppose what Shane Supple is saying is kind of halfway to you, is that we're not an international setup. Like, I mean, you look at... Rugby is a much smaller sport, but I tell you what, like, they have a world-class coach who's hungry for it, has proven a lot, wants to learn more. Again, and you going back to the antithesis of it, which is kind of the fixed mindset, like, you can see that Martin O'Neill, well, this worked for me, and I did all this with Leicester, etc. And it was, what he did with some of those setups was brilliant. But has he, a bit, no more than Trapattoni, who has had an unbelievable CV, but wasn't learning from either his mistakes or what's going on out there.
He still references his European Cup wins with Nottingham Forest. And like, they're utterly irrelevant.
And you can see the cognitive dissonance going on, the way he's legitimising it. Well, basically it's, well, this is what Cluffy used to do.
Yeah, 40 years ago.
And only have Jack, Big Jack, did go to a World Cup before in 86. And, you know, he brought his notebook, right, as he said, and he wrote down what he saw. And now he used it to prove that they were all playing this, that everyone was playing the same, and that he could get round this by playing the way he did, right? But he did go there, and he took his notes and confirmed presumably what he thought already. But still, he did that, and it's just interesting. People wouldn't normally think that Jack would do that, do you know?
Yeah.
But he actually did. Now, whether how open-minded he was going out there, we don't know. But still. You know, so it's just interesting that we would normally associate him with very kind of, you know, sure, we'll just go out and kick the ball around a bit, you know. But in fact, he did a bit of homework.
There was some method behind it. Yeah. I want to, because we're up against the clock now, I want to get to a couple of non-football, non-GA related pieces. There's one in the mail. It's written by Mark Gallagher on William Dunlop, who died and was buried in the last week in a road race. And Kieran... I don't know how to speak about.
I read some of Mark's pieces in the Gaa. He had a busy week. He's actually a great pro.
Yeah.
And
but the third member of the Dunlop family.
Yeah, like
you have the mail there, do you?
Yeah,
I highlighted a couple of the I didn't get seeing it.
I don't have it. Yeah, you 70. You were telling me.
Yeah, page 70 there. It's a really and Mark wrote it really well. And I mean, you can't even imagine what that family must be going through, and you know the questions and doubts they must have in their minds for those still involved in the sport, given the amount of tragedy the family have had to go through.
I won't get reading it here, but I must go to it again. But I have to say, just from a remove, you would just have to question: should this be legal? Like, I definitely in the Isle of Man, like it's like that family alone have lost three. I mean, people will talk about lives to be lived, you know, and you know, they died doing the thing that they loved. Although I've read some quotes during the week that his love of it had declined, and you do wonder about even his focus. Like in that, you cannot switch off literally in that. So it's like that's one thing that I haven't seen the follow up, and I'm not off that sport. And I that's a piece I must get to and read more on. But the one thing that it just struck me is this on the agenda? Like, should this be?
Yeah, and the like, problem I mean, is, I guess
we talk about MMA.
MMA
all the time. And let's say when we had it with the young lad from Portugal who died here, and we talk about regulation. Like, that's a family alone who've lost three family members. And nearly, should they be protected from themselves? I mean, obviously, you're going to have some form of motor racing. It's a sport with a great history. But let's say that circuit alone, like that has to be a debate about.
Yeah.
You'd have to think
from I think I recall Joey Dunlop, there was a fascinating documentary about him a few years ago. And it was in the context of the North at the time when, you know, like it was in flames. And Joey Dunlop was this kind of astonishing kind of star of motor racing or bike racing. Mm. And, you know, it got into this really fascinating thing about just the utter fearlessness of Joey Dunlop as a kind of an image for some way out of the whole thing. Do you know what I mean? That you know that there was a fearlessness being displayed by other people in a totally destructive way. Do you know what I mean? And he kind of lived so far on the edge, but in a way that in was sort of, I don't know, kind of life enhancing in a sort of strange kind of a way. But it was very interesting about just the context of him doing this crazy, crazy sport.
Yeah, Mark actually captures that in the way that he writes about it. He says, you know, Robert, who was Willie's uncle or father, and Joey was his uncle. They both wrestled with their own doubts about their way of life, but they always came back. The spectre of death stalks the sport. Mm. Every day they go out, they know it might be the day they're not coming home. Mm. And Michael, who's still riding, still racing, he wrote in his biography in 2008, since 2008 when his father died, death is a familiar foe to road racers. She's always there, just out of the corner of your eye, watching, waiting. Death is responsible for the man I am today. My dad going, my winning that race the day before his funeral, continuing the Dunlop dynasty. These events shaped me in ways I could never have imagined if they hadn't happened. I mean, it's incredible stuff, but...
Well, you see, at the time of when Joey Dunlop, like, the spectre of death was everywhere in people's lives as well, without getting near a motorbike, do you know? So it's interesting, like, how, you know, he might have done a deal with himself and said, like, what difference does it make? At least I'm kind of pushing something as far as I can go life is so kind of cheap in Northern Ireland at the time anyway. It kind of maybe justified it in some way or gave a kind of a rationale for it, you know.
But there won't be a fallout. Like whenever we lose two or three horses in the Grand Slam or the Grand National at Aintree, there's always a debate whether or not this should be continued, whether this should be allowed to happen. That is this not animal cruelty? And as you've mentioned the UFC situation, the MMA situation, I'm not sure we'll ever hear a proper debate as to whether motorbike racing in these environments, these circumstances, should be outlawed. But, well,
I must read that piece because, you seek to understand, first of all. But at the same time, there is an element of you've got to remove yourself from the sport and look at it from a distance and ask that question.
We're going to finish with a fascinating piece. It's in the Sunday Times. It was written by Nick Pitt, and it's with the ex-wife of Jean Van de Velde. I would assume or maybe hope that the vast majority of our listeners, as soon as you mention John van de Velde, they know exactly the circumstances, the context. Mm. For those that maybe really only started watching golf maybe from the 2000s onwards, he was the French, eccentric French golfer in 1999 that arrived on the 72nd hole at Carnoustie, probably the toughest golf course in the world given the conditions at that week, and had a three-shot lead and basically threw the three-shot lead away, ended up in a playoff, lost. Paul Lowry won the Open Championship that week. Mm. But that doesn't tell even half the story, because it involved him taking his trousers, shoes and socks off, rolling his trousers up to his knees, getting into the Barry Byrne. Mm. Anyway, do you want to take it up from there, Kieran?
Well, it jumped out. It's fascinating because it's with his ex-wife who happened, and it's his ex-wife, and who was his coach, and 3 years after Carnoustie was his ex-wife. And it touches on the piece that after Carnoustie he wasn't the same person. For all the, you'd have to say he handled it with great class, you know.
Huge dignity,
and she made the point, and he actually did a great up and down at the very end. Because remember, let's face it, Porrick was there too. And Porrick happened to turn it around. The point is, he's carried on. He's had a certain persona, had a laugh at himself, nearly a Gareth Southgate pizza. But she was living with him and said, although his nightmare with humour and good grace, but Bridget has darker memories. After Carnoustie, he wasn't the same person. Our relationship changed. It was the start of a new Jean, a Jean that I had not known before, the famous Jean. The joy had gone. He never forgave himself for what happened at Carnoustie. He lost his love of the game. Mm. It's fascinating. It was a great piece for Nick Pitt to get. The one thing for me is, and I've touched upon this here several times, it's one of the drawbacks of the Sunday Times policy at the moment, of very few pieces over 1,100 words. And that, could you imagine a Kimmage with that piece? Mm. I'm sure if Nick Pitt had the same space, he'd give it a good shot. But you want it more.
I feel a little shortchanged reading it.
Yeah, it's a huge issue with
getting the two people that you wanted to get inside the head of that were there that afternoon, Declan, outside of Jean van de Velde himself.
Yeah,
his wife and his caddy.
She was a very good golfer herself. She describes how she wanted to actually say to him, par five, treat it as a par five, the last hole, but you can't actually give instructions to golfers
like
that.
Yeah, she says...
She makes the really important point.
We were young and dreaming. Jean used to say, I ever find myself leading a major championship with one hole to play, I'll play it safe. Yeah. I'll even take a wedge off the tee.
But she makes the point as well, though, that he didn't choke, right? That because he sank that putt.
The putt in the playoff.
Anyone who had been was a broken man could not have put that in. But also he was really unlucky that after the drive, the second shot, it should have just gone into the stands, but it hit a bit of the stand and ricocheted into a far worse place. So it's funny how we settle on a kind of a version of things, that this was the greatest choke in the history of the world. And in fact, it was really unlucky.
Pressure did have a choice on his decision, because
it was a meltdown, Declan, really.
To use that term, he didn't stick with what he had in mind. Right, so that was a bit of pressure on not keeping to it. So he lost a bit of it. He got a couple of bad breaks. No more like Parrick Harrington, you could say, choked, and yet he recovered brilliantly. But again, going back to it, as you said, it's just touching upon the line. And as much as certain privacy has to be respected, you know, but he was not the same. Like, how was he not the same? You know, just to have the line that. He lost his love of the game. The joy had gone. You would just love to read more, but it's a fascinating take. And obviously, the Open's going back to Carnoustie next year.
Yeah, we hear the word Carnoustie, all we think of is Jean van de Velde. It was he blocked his drive onto the 17th fairway, and immediately you should have been thinking, right, that was really the wrong play. I've got away with this here. Mm-hmm. I'll just chug 2 7 irons down, hit the fairway here, maybe take 3 putts, double bogey, I'll still walk off with the claret jug. And she says, with the light fading, there was a rush to get the four-hole playoff started. I had to run up to our room to get John a dry pair of trousers, because he'd got into like a stream, basically, considering hitting a ball out of the water. There was no time to talk to him. I wanted to calm him down and to say that whatever happened on the 18th, I was proud of him, proud of what he had done all week. It's one of the great stories of sport, let alone golf, and it's probably up there with the most riveting hours of sports TV that we have ever seen.
And it also has that thing about golf that, he hit really one bad shot from which six or seven others naturally followed, right? But the crucial, terrible decision was the tee shot, you know. And it's just one of those odd things about maddening things about something like golf, that it's a one mistake multiplies.
And it's he had it. Yeah. Like, he came second. Like, Jean Van der Velde, had he ever been on the near the top of the leaderboard in a major, he came second. But it wasn't
He didn't ever he didn't finish in the top two, even in the end.
Yeah.
And I do feel that
it was a three-way playoff.
It affected him, because I know he went to the Ryder Cup that year, and whatever about Mark James, who for me is one of the worst Ryder Cup captains there's ever been, clearly didn't fancy him, left him out of the team until the singles, when he'd absolutely no time to play the course, and obviously his mind would have been scrambled. Got a hiding on the singles that day. And we never really, I know he had injury issues, we never really heard from him again. And as you say, it would have been great to get more detail on why their marriage ended 3 years later. Mm. How much of it does she believe was down to what happened by the Barry Byrne that afternoon? How much of it was just that marriage, that relationship was running its natural course?
Because, you know, like, that's bigger when you think of it, like, you know, than losing the Open. It lost his marriage as a result of how they handled it or reacted to it. Again, it was it's a fascinating piece, and it's well written by Nick Pitt with the space he had available. But that is why sometimes you know, there's a lot to be said for, let's say.
But also just the role of luck in a lot of these things. It was the same with England. And one thing we never acknowledged about all the penalty shootouts they lost, they were kind of unlucky. Do you know what I mean? Similarly, he had one terrible stroke of bad luck on that hole, that, you know, a ball ricocheted in a way it never normally would. And
he could have got away with it. He could have got away bad luck, though.
He did, yeah, but it was still
unlucky. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, we don't want to, kind of allow for that. We prefer sort of stories of destiny, or stories of, like, you know, people deliberately doing terrible things because they're of some personal weakness or whatever. Whereas the role of things that are completely, you know, ridiculous, they don't fit as easily into our kind of the narrative that we want to kind of accept about something. So it's interesting that in that way as well. And as she said, after all that stuff, after, you know, going for a swim practically on the last hole, he still held a great putt. Mm. You know, you know, how complex is that? Like, you know, how, you know, everything is just so much more complex than we often kind of allow for, and we just prefer the simple black and white story of the greatest choker who ever lived. And in fact, in a way, he wasn't. Like, you know, it's a nice
note to finish on. Declan, thanks a million for joining us this afternoon. Loved it. And Kieran, thanks a million. Really appreciate it. Enjoy the game of croquet. Okay, I hope you get a belter. You.